Welcome to OMJ.
Oh, I'm supposed to say J. My bad.
I need you to work that out.
I'm like the second J. Am I the first year or the second J?
I'm the first J.
I should be the first J.
No.
OM Jessica and Josh.
J E J O.
It should be, yeah, but Josh is shorter than Jessica.
It makes no difference. I'm first. Thanks.
Appreciate I feel as though I'm in the twilight zone, but ain't no twilights.
There is no lights nor twice. Let's keep going. So, today we have a special guest on our show.
All the way from Toronto, Canada.
Guess what? We have the pregnant lawyer, Mr. Harold Harvey, on OMJJ Podcast today. Guys, listen, this man has saved many of lives just by doing what he had done as a lawyer. Today, we're going to highlight his book. We're going to talk a little bit about him. We're going to talk about his past. We're going to talk about what he's doing right now and what he's moving toward in the future. We're very honored to have you on the show today, Mr. Harvey. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm actually honored to be here today.
Yay.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Well, guess what? Today's your day. It's all about you. So I hope we're not interrogating or harassing you.
Oh, we're going to interrogate and harass.
Well, here's the thing. I've been doing a lot of research on what you've done.
Yeah, you're amazing.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. Especially how you just fell into this kind of accidentally.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't wake up wanting to do this. Well, you're going to be a lawyer, but not the kind of lawyer that you're doing. So, yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. And so I'm thoroughly impressed by what you have done. And actually,
and she never gets impressed.
And that's the truth, because I don't even
she don't even press her clothes, because you're not iron.
I don't like to iron. That's right. And so literally what I like the most about doing my research about you is what you have done for college students, some students up in the Atlanta area. We'll get into that shortly, but tell us a little about you. Who's Harold Harvey? What should people know about
you? He got three names.
That is true.
Harold Michael Harvey. He's not a serial killer. Let's get that
I was
straight.
Told, don't trust a man with three first names.
Well, I was told that my mother wanted to name me Harold, and my grandmother said that he's more of a Michael than a Harold.
How would they know that when you were born?
My grandmother was very intuitive.
Okay.
That's right.
And I talk about her in Freaknik.
Yeah.
Awesome.
You know, so that's how I come by the name of Harold Michael Harvey.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Beautiful name, by the way.
Yeah, three first names or three last names, depending upon how
no,
you
pronounce it. No, three first names.
That's right.
First name?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they just using the wrong order.
Yes.
I'm not here to judge you.
That's right. And so tell us a little bit about you. Where are you currently located? Are you here in the Macon area? Are you in Atlanta? Where's your location?
I live in Atlanta. I've lived in Atlanta, I guess, for the last 40 years or 39 years or about. I grew up here in Macon. I left Macon in 1980, went back to school, went to law school, practiced law in Atlanta for about 20 years, and got out of the business early 2000s. And did a little of nothing for a few years, and all of a sudden I woke up one night and I went to my computer and I typed, I am a writer. Mm. And and that sort of like redefined me, and I started writing.
Wow. Is this how you created this awesome book? You've written other books, though.
I've written other books. In fact, in the late 70s, I had started a manuscript entitled Paper Puzzle. Had worked on it, and then when I left Macon, I put it aside when I went back to school. Mm-hmm. And I didn't work on it anymore. I had about 30,000 words of a novel done. And one Thanksgiving in November, around about 1999 or 2000, I was here in Macon visiting with my mother. And she, as I was packing up to take some of her delicious food back to Atlanta with me, she walks down the hallway and says, you know, here, I was up in the attic this week and I ran across your manuscript. You never did finish that novel. So I took the manuscript. It was in a cigar box with my baseball cards that I had collected when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And took the manuscript to my office, filed it away under P. And it sat there for several years. And when I was closing my office, I ran across the manuscript. And I decided while I was waiting to disperse my files that I would take those typewritten pages, because in the 1970s we didn't have
computers,
a computer.
That's right.
You know, so I took them and I threw the manuscript into the computer. added some to it, worked on it a little bit, and forgot about it. And about 5 years later, 2008, I saw this advertisement for True TV was looking for the next great mystery writer. Hmm. And I said, well, paper puzzle, that was a nice mystery. Mm-hmm. So I dug it out and I submitted it. So they wanted 10,000 words. I submitted the first 10,000 words of paper puzzle. Shortly after my submission, I got a call from the person in charge of submissions, and they wanted to know if it was a short story or a full-length novel, because it had to be a full-length novel. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, it's not complete, but it is a full-length novel, or will be a full-length novel. And I was informed that, well, I can't tell you what we are in the process, but we're going to make announcements in February, and your manuscript has to be ready to go to print by April. Mm-hmm. Would you, if you were one of the winners, three winners, would you be able to go to press by April? It's no way. Because I started the series work, and I just could not figure out how to crunch that out in such a short period of time. In fact, I did do it in 4 months. So I worked on it a little bit. I was a little disheartened. And a few days went by, and all of a sudden it hits me. You would not have gotten that phone call had they not been interested in that manuscript. Mm-hmm. Says, you're on to something here. You've got to finish this. Right. So I started working and did a little bit in December, did a little bit like January, did a little bit in February. By March, I'm not working on it, right? So in July, I asked my wife of 29 or 30 years at that point in time, if I could find a cabin in Tennessee and go away, and she stay in Atlanta, and I go and just write for a year until I finished. Mm. And without blinking or giving it a second thought, she says, yes, if you think you can do it, go do it. Mm. So we went up, found a cabin, and I sort of like bare-boned it, and I worked from 2 a.m. in the morning to 7. She likes to read at night before going to bed, and so I would then call her around 8, and instead of her reading herself to sleep, I would read her what I had written the morning before. And then she would give me advice. I think that character needs to be fleshed out a little bit more, or maybe work on this, or I think you're on to it, keep going. Mm-hmm. Then I would go to bed, wake up again at 2 a.m. and work from 2 to 7, and that process. And it actually took me 4 months mm-hmm. to complete the manuscript.
Wow.
And so that's Paper Puzzle, set in the 1970s, Middle Georgia, Macon, Georgia.
Oh, wow.
You read it, you may find, well, you're not from here, but being from here, you may recognize some characters, some scenes, some things that occurred in the past.
Wow, that's impressive.
That's Paper Puzzle.
Did they pick it up?
No, they did not. I mean, that process was done because
okay.
I didn't meet the qualification. I didn't meet the deadline.
Okay.
Although I did meet the deadline, I didn't know that I could do it in 4 months.
Okay.
But once I started, I mean, the stuff just flowed. The words just came. And it was like a muse would wake me up every morning at 2 o'clock, like clockwork. If I stayed out late and maybe didn't get to bed till 12:30 or 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I'd wake up.
What did it mean? First of all, can we get the book anywhere?
Paper Puzzle, you can't get anywhere because it's out of print. However, uh-huh. This is the 10th anniversary. It was released in December of 2009.
Uh-huh.
So this December will be the 10th anniversary. I will have a 10th anniversary edition coming out in December.
Really?
Wow.
Really.
Let us know.
We'll do.
Oh, we'll do. I can just come by your house. I got a flash drive. Just give me the file. I'm not gonna sell it.
You're not gonna sell it.
I will tell people to buy it though.
There you go.
I mean, I'll be your reviewer.
Well, I mean, you know, that's advertisement, so maybe we can work something out.
I definitely do that for you.
Yeah. Okay.
I get very good reviews. But your stuff sucks.
Oh.
They were like, well, what do you think about Paper Puzzle? Man, he can really spell. What about the book? Man, the cover is amazing. So if your book ain't no good, but I'm sure it's going to be excellent.
It is a good book.
Can you talk to the fact about how you had to go to a quiet place mm-hmm. or a certain space to write?
Yeah.
Some people think mm-hmm. that you have to be around a bunch of noise to activate your brain.
Yeah.
But in many cases, from a communication standpoint, for stuff to be communicated to you, you got to block all that stuff out.
So true.
Can you break that down for us?
I'll try. Well, first of all, I think in terms of writing, and there are a lot of people who want to write and they never take the steps to do it. Writing is sort of like you have to approach writing like you would your prayer time, your meditation time, your yoga time. You have to designate a time and a space, and you have to say how long a duration that time is, okay? And every day at that time, you go to that space and you write. And so even in those times when nothing creative really comes, you know, if it's 2 a.m., it's time to write, and there's just nothing but gibberish floating around in my brain, well, that's what I write. You know, because it's the process, it's the practice, it's the repetition, it's going to that space. And now the other thing is, I think to get a good story out of you, that muse inside of you, or that spirit, that God, or whatever you believe in, that is inside of you, that you have to, at least for me, have to go to a quiet space and talk to that muse and talk to that God and listen to that God and exchange ideas with that God. And then the words of just sort of come out of the spirit onto the paper. You know, so that's sort of like the approach that I take to writing, is that you have to listen to the voice inside of you. And you have to talk to that voice, and you will get guidance and directions in terms of what the spirit want you to communicate to the people, other people in the world.
So you have to go to a place, to be in a space where you can hear what you're supposed to listen to.
That's so true.
I just did
You just did that?
I just did that. Two things. Are you familiar with Mark Victor Hansen?
Yes.
You Chicken Soup for the Soul?
Uh-huh. Yes.
He told me directly, and he said, Josh, everybody has a story. He says, no matter what you've been through, no matter what your life is, everybody has a story. And he said, every book can be a bestseller. He said, but the first thing you got to do is write it.
Is write it. That's right.
And when you say, when you wrote to your screen and said, I am a writer, talk about what that did to you. Because real quick, I deal with a lot of young people, and I tell them, if you say things and vocalize them, then visualize them, it automatically activates the process. But sometimes people are so fearful of even saying it. So they keep the negative energy right here because they don't want to say the positive because they don't think it's possible. I say, burn the positive. Just say what you are, and that's what you're going to become. So speak about when you said, I am a writer.
You know, that moment in time comes to me when I'm really trying to redefine myself. You know, I had spent this long period of time, you know, as a fire-breathing litigator, and now I find myself outside of that space, and so I'm not quite sure who I am. You can do a thing for such a long period of time until you become that thing, and so now I'm no longer that thing, and I'm trying to find my way. And so the muse woke me up, and I went to the computer, and that is what came out. I am a writer. And so I redefined myself. I was trying to define myself. And by invoking those words, it said, yes, you are. You've always written. And maybe now is the time for you to get back to writing. And I started writing. And so after Paper Puzzle, it had a pretty good success in the early 2010 to 2014 or so. And then we had these incidents that occurred in 2012 with the murder of Trayvon Martin and of Jordan Davis. And when those jury trials eventually took place and the verdicts, with a legal education, had a hard time understanding the jury verdicts. So I was waking one morning and the muse said, well, you've got to explain what just happened to lay people. Because if you're having a problem processing this, maybe you need to talk about it. So then I went to work on my second book, which is Justice in the Round, Essays on the American Jury System. Mm. The big problem I found with both of those trials, the Trayvon Martin trial and that first Jordan Davis trial, is that the prosecutors did not actively engage the prospective juror panel on their racial feelings. Mm-hmm. Now, as a trial lawyer in the 80s and the 90s and early 2000s, I was always confronted with this dichotomy of race in my cases. Mm-hmm. And so I had to find a way, and usually I travel the state and try cases, not only in Atlanta in the metropolitan area, but the further you get outside of the metropolitan area, you're in primarily white counties, where the only black people in the courtroom would be myself and my client. Mm. Mm. So the task becomes, how do you then get white jurors to release themselves from their environmental culture, their racial prejudices that they probably are not even aware that they have? Mm. And so I developed a way to do that. I had a young man who was charged with murder toward the end of 1999. I believe we started trying the case in January of 2000. Mm-hmm. I was convinced that he did not participate in the murder. Before I took the case, I had seen news accounts of a murder one weekend. And I remember sitting on the couch watching the news, and then my wife looked at me and I looked at her and I said, those guys deserve whatever they get. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Well, lo and behold, on Monday morning, the mother of three of the kids called me. And when my secretary told me who was on the phone, I says, I want to talk to her because I don't want to have anything to do with that case. Mm-hmm. But she continued to call. And so I would never come and take the phone call. And so she started in on my secretary the second day on Tuesday. And I wouldn't take the call, and she would continue to call on the hour. Well, it was Mr. Harvey back from court. He's in court. I'm sitting right there. Hmm. And so finally, the secretary says, Mr. Harvey, you've got to talk to this lady because she just worn me down. So I get on the phone. And she gives me the spiel about her sons are innocent and they're going to kill my boys. I need somebody. Johnny Cochran told me to call you, and you're the only person that can help save my boys. And I love Johnny Cochran, but he was not about to pull me into that case. But I could not get her off the phone. So I did. I thought I lied. I said, I tell you what.
Lawyers lie?
I couldn't lie.
That's news.
But I thought I told one. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll be up there first thing in the morning. I have no idea. I mean, I'm not going up there. Mm-hmm. But
you just lied.
I just lied. I thought. But it got her off the phone. Mm-hmm. So she hangs up, says, oh, great, I'll see you in the morning. So I get home and I tell my wife that I finally talked to the lady. She says, well, what did you tell her? I said, well, I told her I'd be up there first thing in the morning. She says, I thought you said you didn't want to have anything to do with that case. I don't. But I had to get her off the phone. Mm. So I have dinner, go to bed. 2 o'clock in the morning, I sit straight up in the bed. God says, you got to go to Bartow County. Mm. So I said, okay, I'm going to get a shower. I'm going to go down to the office. Because I hadn't prepared to be out of the office that day. So I've got to prepare some things I need my secretary to work on. And I see probably about 8 o'clock, I'll head up to Bartow County. I get up there. I talk to all of them. And all of a sudden, I'm talking to this one of the brothers in this family. It was three brothers and a friend of the brothers accused of this very brutal murder. And so I talked to the oldest of the brothers. And, you know, he's talking to me, but I'm not listening to him. And he realizes I'm not listening to him. So he begins to yell at me.
Oh, wow.
Look at me. Look him at the top of his voice, he yelled, look at me, look at me, look at me. And so for the first time, I looked at him. He says, I don't even look like my brothers. I said, oh, yeah, you don't. Mm. He says, you know, you talk to my brothers again, you tell them they better tell you the truth. So I did. And so, no, he had no idea what we were about to go do. He just came along for the ride. He had no idea what was going on. So I knew that I was an innocent man that was facing the electric chair if I did not do something.
Interesting.
So I undertook the case. But now I've got a very brutal murder of a white teenager. Four black kids are accused of having committed the murder. The prosecutor never calls the defendants by their name. He said they did, them and they.
That's a subconscious tactic.
There you go. Them and they were on trial. Never called my guy's name, anything that he actually did, because he didn't do anything in furtherance of that particular act, right? So I had to figure out, how are you going to convince these jurors to set aside their racial biases and prejudices for 3 weeks and listen to the evidence? Because they listen to the evidence, they'll let this guy go. But I know if I can't get them to listen, you know, they're all going to go down the tube. So I thought about something that had taken place with me when I played baseball at Tuskegee in college.
Oh, you were Tuskegee?
Yes. Sure. So one day on the baseball field, we were at home, and Savannah State comes over to Tuskegee to play us. And Savannah State had one white player on the team. He was a catcher. So I'm sitting out on first base, and the batter comes up and hits the ball in the gap. And so we are up by about 5 or 6 runs, and Savannah hadn't pressed us. And it's hot. I mean, it can get real hot in Alabama.
Can it?
Yo, man. It was hot that day. So I didn't run fast. I got to second base, and I was going to pull up, and I looked over to third, and coach is saying, and so now I got to turn on to get to third. And then I'm coming to third, I'm going to pull up again, right, because I'm not hustling. It's hot. And we have enough runs, I thought. But when I get to third, he's telling me to go home. So I've loafed, and he really yells at me, probably cursed at me. And so now I know I really got to get in there because I didn't hustle. And I never wanted the coach to yell at me for not hustling. If I made a mistake, fine, if I gave my all. But I knew that I wasn't trying hard. So I tried real hard, and I could feel the ball coming to the back of my head as I approached the plate. I did one of my Jackie Robinson slides where a little fadeaway slide on the outside corner of the plate. And so when I turn around, there's just a plume of smoke, of dust. And I don't know if I'm safe or I'm out. So the catcher is walking towards me. So I just, white kid, a little smaller than me, I picked him up and dumped him down, stepped on the base. Umpire says, you're safe. He didn't chastise me for dumping the catcher. That was obviously not a baseball move. The umpire was the postman in the community. I would run into him in town at the grocery store and stuff. A very moral man. Never said a word to me. Coach Martin, very moral man. Never said a word to me. But when I reached the first step of the dugout, Stephen Duval, who lives here in Macon.
I think I know.
You know Steve?
Yeah.
Steve was our first baseman. And Steve and I were in high school, so Steve has known me for years. When I get to the first step, he points his finger in my face and says, boy, you're a racist. And I'm stunned. My mama didn't raise me to be a racist. But the only way I can explain having picked that catcher up and dumped him is because he was white, and he was the only white person in the ballpark. And I knew the coach, I knew the umpire would not say anything to me about it. And that's what racism is. It is
that's
power
interesting.
To control the destiny and the outcome of a situation for someone else.
Wow.
So I sat there in that dugout because Steve had called me out. He knew I was better. And he wouldn't let me get away with it, what the coach and the umpire did. So I sat there in the dugout and I said, I've got to change this, all right? And when I went back out on the field, I had resolved in myself that I was never going to act that way again or be let any type of subconscious, hold any type of subconscious racial feeling, a bias or prejudice against somebody else. That was what I'd always fought against. And here I was acting it out.
So you told that story in court?
I told that story in court. First I asked, is there anyone in this panel a racist, a harboring racial feelings against anybody black? And I would raise my hand. And of course, none of the white people sitting in the panel would raise their hand. And so then I would go through this spiel and tell the story. Hmm. Told the story all week. So now, and when we broke for lunch on the first day, you know, the bailiff stopped me on my way out of the courtroom. Were you safe or were you out?
Black guy, white guy?
White guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my client and I and my wife, who helped me to pick juries, she doesn't have a legal degree.
Uh-huh.
She has a sociology degree.
Oh, wow. That's more important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She knows people.
Yeah.
And so I would take her in important trials to gauge the jurors. Because, you know, one thing about a wife is, you know, she'll look and she'll say, we're discussing who we're going to pick, and I'll say, well, I think juror number so-and-so is kind of maybe a good juror.
Uh-huh.
She'll say, you didn't see how she looked at you.
Uh-oh.
They know. They pay attention.
That's right.
Women.
Uh-huh. Say, oh, no, you didn't see how she was looking
at you. How was she looking at you?
Who knows, but she...
Oh, she know.
Yeah, she knew that she didn't like me, you know.
Well, okay.
So more than likely she would vote against me.
That's what
she said. That's
right.
But so on the ride back, we were on the ride back to Atlanta. Get halfway back to Atlanta, and I said, oh, they're listening. That's what I wanted them to do.
Good.
They're listening. And the same thing on Tuesday. We leave the courthouse for lunch and for the end of the day, and everybody would ask me, "Where you safe? Where you at?" I said, "At least they're listening."
Yes.
And so yeah. that was a plus.
And the trick is, don't answer the question.
There you go.
Yeah, that's another conversation.
On Wednesday.
Like. Yeah.
On Wednesday, when we finished the voir dire for Wednesday at the end of the day, 5:00, judge clears the courtroom. I thought, now I go up to the line, right? I wouldn't cross the line,
uh-huh.
but I would go up to the line. Uh-huh. So I said, oh my God, you know, I've crossed the line. He's going to chew me out. But he says, at lunchtime, a deputy came to me and said that when he was on his way into the courthouse on Monday morning, juror number so-and-so asked him, what did he think about that nigga lawyer from Atlanta?
Uh-huh.
Now, what do you want me to do? I want you to strike him. I don't want to use my strike.
Mm-hmm.
So we resolve the legal issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're on our way back home again. Halfway to Atlanta, I said, bingo, we just won that case.
Mm.
She said, what are you talking about? We just won the case.
The judge did not have to do that.
He didn't have to do that, but more importantly, it's the police, it's the sheriff deputy.
That's right. That's
the sheriff knew on Monday morning that was a racist, biased statement for a juror to say about a lawyer
mm-hmm.
who was going to try a case before him.
Wow.
But it was normal. It was white folks talking to white folks, and he didn't say a word about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I humanized them yeah. with the story of my racist actions when I was a college student
yeah.
caused that juror 3 days later to come forth and say something that he had heard a juror say
mm.
3 days before.
Did you know it was yours said it?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I was 72, 73-year-old guy.
Mm.
So we got him off the panel. We had him to stand up the next day when the judge.
So everybody saw, ooh-wee.
But they don't know what, we never discussed.
Oh, they never know why he got kicked off. Okay.
Never knew why he got kicked off. But that was why he got kicked off. And that was why I knew it won the case. Because that meant that if that officer had been, socialized by that story,
mm-hmm.
the people on the jury panel would be.
That's
and,
right.
And so my guy was acquitted of malice murder. And
what's he doing now?
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I haven't seen him in years.
Yeah. How'd the mother act afterwards?
She was elated over that because it saved his life. One of her kids did actually get the death sentence. He hasn't. It has never been carried out.
Mm-hmm.
But she was happy that one didn't, and I think the third child didn't get it. He got life, and the third child, which was the youngest, got life.
Mm.
The middle child got death.
My goodness.
That sentence is still pending.
Mm.
You know. So, but yeah, that worked out for them.
Wow.
And so that's what I would do. And that's what the prosecutors failed to do in the Trayvon Martin case in the first Jordan Davis case.
Mm-hmm.
They failed to pull out the racial biases and prejudices that all people have.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And it's socialization, it's culture. You wake up with it in the mornings, and I would always ask my jurors, you know, to set that aside. When you walk inside the courthouse, if you could just set that aside.
Yeah.
Now you can pick that garment up when this is over.
On your way out.
In 3 weeks. But for right now, set that aside. And so that's what Justice in the Round, Essays on the American Jury System, attempted to explain that for the lay public, and also if, you know, if lawyers or prosecutors or defense attorneys, criminal defense attorneys, will read it, they could probably learn a thing or two from, you know, my experiences in picking juries. So that's book number two.
Wow.
And then, of course, Freaknik Lawyers, book number three, and why I wrote the book. A production company. There's a documentary out on Freaknik.
Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of them, isn't it?
Well, there's one that I'm in.
Okay.
And that's the one I know about. And, you know, so this group that came down from New York, and they wanted to talk to me. It took us, we talked about it for a couple of months before I finally agreed to talk about it.
Can you give a quick outline of what Freaknik is for people who don't know?
Mm-hmm. Freaknik was a Black College Spring Festival that occurred in Atlanta, Georgia, on the third weekend in April every year. That started around the early 1980s, 80, 81, probably 10 or 15 kids at Clark College. They had merged with Atlanta University at that point in time. And Spelman, who got together because they couldn't go home for spring break. You know, the campus was cleared. People who could go home for spring break had gone. And the people left on the campus, they threw a blanket on the lawn, got some music, the boom box, and got a little boom farm also. And
Boone's Farm.
They were probably drinking something else in the 80s. Though, but I'm aging myself.
But, Lord,
but at any rate, they had a little picnic. And the following year, I believe Morehouse and Morris Brown came along, and so now, you know, you got 50 kids, maybe 100.
Really?
And
off of a picnic.
Off of a picnic because they couldn't go home, you know, during the spring break period of time.
Uh-huh.
And so they would come together that weekend of that Friday or Saturday and hang out and just have fun and socialize. And so, but then the crowds kept getting bigger, and then the word began to get out among other Black college students throughout the country, and eventually got to Black students at predominantly white colleges and universities. And so people started coming to Atlanta in droves, and the guys would come, and they would rent cars. I mean, these nice sports cars and nice SUVs, and they would parade around Atlanta. Mostly in Southwest Atlanta, in the Black areas. And I believe in 1995, we were a year out from the Atlanta Olympics. The crowd is so large in 95 that it boggles the traffic.
It shuts it down. I've never been, but I got friends who went, and they said it shut the city down. Well, and they can't wait till it happened.
Right.
Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of fun for college kids. But in '95, so many people came, and there were so many cars that's the first time that the city could not manage the traffic.
Huh.
And probably because it caught them off guard. Nobody expected that number of people to come into the city for that weekend, and so your public safety vehicles, emergency vehicles, couldn't get out.
Oh, wow.
Police couldn't get out to their calls. So the city was sort of like at a bottleneck. Weeks following the 95 event, the chamber, the mayor, elected officials got together and said, we've got to do something. And so the word went out that you've got to discourage them from coming to the city of Atlanta. So in 1996, in April, ahead of the Olympics, which would have been later that summer, I think it may have started in June or July, the city, the mayor, announced that he would crack down and that arrests would be made. I thought it was wrong to arrest Black college students and give them records, arrest records, and in some case, I guess that would be convictions, criminal records, convictions on their records. So I was, at that point in time, I believe, vice president of the Gate City Bar Association.
Hello, Gate City.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I asked the president if I could then organize a group of lawyers from Gate City to represent the kids, and he agreed. And so we set it into motion. The press conference, you know, said that we would represent kids who were arrested during Freaknik as long as it didn't involve violence, drugs, or guns. Okay. So when the day of reckoning came, no lawyer showed up for me. So I had to, it was my idea. I had to go forward, and so I did. I represented 180 kids the first weekend in 1996, 165 in 1997, and I believe 75 in 1998. Did not do it beyond that point in time.